how, 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 how. Hey,
hey. Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. Come on home, baby. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about the issues that can impact our lives. Today, we're going to talk about 25 minutes of meditation eases stress from Carnegie Mellon University. Then we're going to explore Princeton University's exercising making the brain more resilient to stress. And then we're going to look at the Obama administration allows levels of radiation in drinking water to dramatically increase. That's not good. We'll explore that as well. Also today, we're going to look at the Department of Homeland Security. 100 million Americans could lose power in a major sunstorm, what we've been talking about for a long time. Well, finally, we've seen a document that says that it's serious. This is from Homeland Security. So for those of you who thought, well, that's not going to happen, well, they're planning on it happening. They believe it can happen. And so FEMA has looked at a study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and says, yeah, this could leave, quote, 130 million people without power for years and destroy or damage more than 300 hard-to-replace electrical grid transformers. So for those of you who acted in a prudent manner, you were on the right side of this. We're also going to look at how we should be living a different life. I have a Remarkable Minds conversation coming up. This is a continuation of a series I started long ago. It's called Conversations with Remarkable Minds. We're going to discuss the path for a shift in consciousness for a new awakened paradigm of global and local leadership. Now, it's going to be in two parts. Today, it will be with a woman who has won the Nobel Prize. And she is Celia Elworthy, and she's an independent peace builder and activist and founder of the Oxford Research Group at Oxford University. So we're going to talk with her. Tomorrow it'll be a conversation with Remarkable Minds for the better part of the program, and it'll be with a person who I have an enormous amount of respect for, who talks a lot about what no one else in the media will even begin to discuss. Henry Giroux, on how we become a nation of zombies. Our democracy is a zombie democracy. He'll explain that in detail. We have a lot to share, and we want to get into it, so let's get into it now. First up, 25 minutes of meditation eases stress. Now, we could all use some de-stressing. And the trouble is, depending upon where you live, the relationships you have, the type of work you do, and your mindset, do you really give yourself 25 minutes a day to just relax and think of nothing that's stressful? Well, if you would do that, then you would benefit tremendously. That's according to Carnegie Mellon University researchers. They say, quote, more and more people report using meditation practices for stress reduction, but we know very little about how much you need to do for stress reduction healthy benefits. So they enlisted a group of people, 18 to 30-year-olds, and they did this and found that it only took 3 days of 25 minutes a day to have substantial benefit. They received the brief mindfulness meditation training using just deep breathing and just relaxing your mind. You don't have to take a class in it. Look, if you were just to go to a quiet place, and New York is surrounded by beauty, I like to sometimes go up to the Cloisters. It's just 3 minutes north of the George Washington Bridge, and it was built by the Rockefeller family, brought over from Europe, and it's an actual cloisters, and they have gardens, and just to sit in those gardens is wonderful. The botanical garden in Brooklyn is beautiful. The one in the Bronx is beautiful. We have places in Central Park just to go and sit. The key is three things. Be alone, stay quiet, and be in the presence of something that is beautiful. Rivers, oceans, mountains, parks, streams. You could even sit in a museum if it were quiet enough. I like to sit in front of the great master painter Turner and look at his paintings. They just transform me. It's just very peaceful. Do that for 25 minutes. No cell phones, no music, just relaxation. Can help you. Now, according to Princeton University, exercise makes your brain more resilient to stress. Quote from Princeton University, anxiety is less likely to interfere with the brain activity if there's regular exercise. This was a laboratory experiment. So just imagine this. Imagine that you get up in the morning and you decide to go for power walking. That's probably the number one exercise in America, because everybody can power walk, or at least most people can. If you can walk, you can power walk. And even in bad weather, people will go to malls, because malls in the morning are encouraging people to come in and to power walk. And that's a big thing. If it's nice weather and you can bike, that's good. If you can go to a swimming pool, if you have a gym to go to. But that makes your brain, not just your muscles, your brain more resilient to stress. It's interesting, because coming up or walking down Broadway, as I frequently do, I like to walk down on the weekends, walk from the Upper West Side, clear down to Soho. Just, you know, go into the galleries and the art studios just to see what people are doing. And it's relaxing walking. It's good for you. But I look up at the gyms, and especially at night, because that's when I walk down to Lincoln Center, I see all the gyms on Broadway packed late. And then you just stand there and you look and you see the intensity on people's faces. So it's one good way for them to burn out a lot of the anxiety and stress that's accumulated during the day. So I encourage you to exercise. And now this research shows you'd be doing yourself a lot of good. We know that a lot of people are not getting a good night's sleep, all for different reasons. The younger generation, because social media is something that many of them simply feel stressed if they give it up, even for a moment. I think it's just poor manners. Maybe we had the last generation that respected manners and some social decorum. If you go out for dinner with someone, you're there to enjoy them and the ambiance and the food, not to sit while you're with someone and start twittering. In the same way, if you go any place, leave the cell phone at home. What's the worst case scenario? Someone's died? Okay, they'll still be dead when you find out about it. This whole idea that we have to know instantaneously everything is just wrong. You know, life is going to go on no matter what. So just leave it behind. Just to show that you care about the people you're with, or even caring about your own quality time. That's one of the things I've noticed at one of the vegan restaurants in New York. I never see people twittering. I see them just relaxed and enjoying themselves when they eat alone or with someone else. So here's the deal. This is from the Medical College of Wisconsin. It showed that when you're not getting a good night's sleep, sleeping with a cell phone near your head, that's a guarantee not to get it. Spending too much time on your computer at night, electromagnetic pulses hitting you, that's another good way not to get it. Sleeping with lights on, another. Eating before you go to bed, another. Staying up too late so you miss your circadian rhythm, another. So what happens is, this is interesting, quote, scientists at the Medical College of Wisconsin have discovered a link between sleep loss and cell injury. Results of a new study in sleep deprivation caused the damage to cells, especially in your liver, your lungs, and your small intestines. Now, you can heal this damage if you get good night's sleeps and start de-stressing. Also, from the California Institute of Technology, they wanted to know, why is it that people are buying so many bad foods? Quote, Some people are able to stick to healthy foods with no issues, while others find chocolate and cake too tempting to turn down. Now, a new study suggests that our dietary self-control may depend upon how fast our brains decide whether food is healthy or not. And here is the takeaway message. That we're hardwired by constant conditioning to rate a food in our brain instantaneously as desirable, and desirable has nothing to do with healthy. It meets one of our desires, our primal desires. Now then, it's also hardwired epigenetically to eat when we're stressed. Because when we're infants, many of us, when we're having a tough time, our mothers, more often than not, will give us something that's pleasant to eat. And that's one of the reasons that cinnamon and vanilla and sweet are so ingrained into us epigenetically to want those when we're stressed. We want something that, at a subconscious level, de-stresses us. It's as if our mother's saying, it's okay. Here, have this. Eat this. So, here's the deal with the brain. And this is a part of neuroscience. In fact, this was published in Psychological Science. That when we look at a food, the first thing happens is our brain will go to where it's most conditioned. If it's conditioned where that's a healthy item, I need that, then we're likely to make that selection. If, however, we look at an item and it's, I want that because I'm used to it, that wins the day. And that's dominant because the vast majority of people, some exclusions, but the vast majority of Americans have been conditioned to believe what they see on television. And they'll buy what's on television. So that's what appears in their mind. That's what their mind records. That's what the response is. That's why people, given all the knowledge about eating healthier, are not doing so. Early exposure to antidepressants affect adult anxiety and serotonin transmissions. This is the University of California. Quote, about 15% of women in the United States suffer from anxiety disorders and depression. During the pregnancy, many are prescribed antidepressants. However, little is known about how early exposure to these medications might affect the offspring after they mature into adults. The answer to this question is vital. As of 5% of all babies born in the United States, more than 200,000 a year, are exposed to antidepressants during gestation and transmission from the newborn mothers, or newborn babies from their mothers. Now, a UCLA team has studied early developmental exposure to two different antidepressants, Prozac and Lexapro, in this scientific study that mimics third trimester medication exposure. They found that although the serotonin selective reuptake inhibiting antidepressants were thought to work the same way, they did not produce the same long-term changes in anxiety behavior. And then it goes on to talk about if you are pregnant and you take these antidepressants, it could affect the child when the child grows up as an adult. So just don't take them. Get therapy, but not pharmaceutical therapy. For those who want to prevent diabetes, who are having some challenges, an interesting article written in the Journal of Leukocyte Biology talks about Chinese licorice. It's been used for more than 4,000 years, and parts of what are called the glycosuramezia plant, the licorice plant, make a difference. Traditional Chinese medicine makes strides against obesity and type 2 diabetes. That's the study. So look at using, if you are diabetic, if you're overweight, and under the care of a healthcare provider, as one part, licorice extract, unless you have high blood pressure. Your ability to balance on one leg reflects your brain health. This is interesting. This is in Coyote University School of Medicine. Quote, balancing on one leg may indicate if a person is at risk of dementia or stroke. Those who struggle to balance on one leg for 20 seconds or longer are at an increased risk of small blood vessel damage in the brain and reduced cognitive function in otherwise healthy people with no clinical symptoms. and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Stroke. A few years ago, researchers found that habitually sleeping less than 6 hours a night, if you're the average person, significantly increases the risk of stroke. Now the shift in studies has leaned towards posture and balance. Quote, our study found that the ability to balance on one leg is an important test for brain health. Okay. Well, try it and see what the outcome is. Now, finally, a lot of people are concerned about their nails, fingernails and toenails. Natural Blaze had an interesting article that I read this morning, and I wanted to share it with you. Why? Because when we look at our fingernails, we should see nails and toenails that are pink, hard, and smooth. They shouldn't be discolored or thick, and they shouldn't be pitted or ridged. If they are, there's an underlying problem. So what then would be the association? Well, let me just share this with you. First of all, one of the most common phenomena out there, discolored nails. And discolored nails show that if there's any green in the nail, that sometimes is bacterial infections. If you had red streaks, that's generally a warning of a heart valve infection. Blue nail, any kind of bluishness in the nails, you're not getting enough oxygen. If you have very dull nails, generally a nutrient deficiency. White nails are liver problems, including hepatitis. And dark stripes, what are called Terry's nails, that's just cognitive heart failure. So thick nails, that's not good because thickening in the nails can mean you could have lung infections, psoriasis, and circulatory problems. Split nails, that's one of the most common things that people complain about. That could be a folic acid, vitamin C, and protein deficiency. And it could also mean chronic malnutrition. Concave nails, what are called spoon nails, iron deficiency, and hypothyroidism. Pitted nails, connective tissue disorder, there's your immune conditions and zinc deficiencies, and ridges in the nails, iron deficiency, lupus, and then dry, brittle nails, thyroid problems, and fungus. Club nails, inflammatory bowel disease, and lung problems. And finally, painkillers that so many Americans use every day. Every year, they're killing more Americans than all heroin and cocaine overdoses combined. That's correct. That's the latest study out, published in the American Journal of Public Health. The United States and Canada are number one and number two per capita when it comes to opiate painkiller consumption. We had 16,000 deaths in 1 year and 24,000, and that does not include aspirin, which is 20,000, I believe, to 24,000 a year by itself. So someone ought to pay a little attention to that when they talk about drugs that kill. Next up, I wanted to take a look at some social issues before we go to our guest. I'm going to give my guest a little extra time today because she has so much to say. But this is from our environmental segment. This is from Christina Sarich of Global Research. Quote, Obama increases allowable levels of radiation in drinking water dramatically. Now, this is based upon a Japanese government official who reported, quote, I was overwhelmed by the amount of contaminated water coming from the reactors. We must dump it in the ocean. This isn't such great news for the United States since President Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency recently gave their approval, quote, to dramatically raising permissible radioactive levels in drinking water and soil following radiological incidents such as nuclear power plant accidents and dirty bombs. The nuclear industry calls this their new normal, according to public employees for environmental responsibility. The EPA has issued radiation guidelines called Protective Action Guides, which allows more radiation than any American has ever been exposed to. And within the guidelines are instructions for evacuation, shelter in place orders, food restrictions, and others that allow larger amounts of radiation. So wouldn't you think that with that radiation from Fukushima continuing 24/7 over 3 years, and the Pacific being contaminated, and the food coming out of that area of Japan, fish and seaweeds being contaminated, shouldn't we be having less exposure? And the answer is we should, but we're allowing more exposure. So much for the president and the EPA who care about our health. And also up is, I thought this was interesting because the Gates Foundation and Bill Gates have given billions of dollars, supposedly to make big differences in Africa. Well, someone who worked with the Minister of Health and of several countries in Africa, I found it rather interesting that what Africans need are good sanitation, so digging healthy wells and making sure they're not filled with arsenic, giving them proper medical care for the conditions historically that they suffer from, whether it's tuberculosis or schistosomiasis, making sure that there is a sustainable food program. And with the knowledge we have today, even in those areas that have been deforested and that are parched, you could still have inexpensively, very easily, hydroponic houses and aquaponic houses that could grow food more than enough for every village. So if you put in health centers, hydroponics, healthy water, and see that the people are not malnourished, then you've gone a long way to saving lives. And there are 26,000 children that die every 24 hours, mainly from Africa, Asia, and South America, from parasitic infections, malnutrition, and contaminated water. Putting in a well is not expensive. But here's the latest on the $1 billion for the, quote, grand challenge of Bill Gates. Quote from Sandy Dalton, Seattle Times. That's Bill Gates' hometown. Despite an investment of $1 billion, none of the projects funded under the Gates Foundation's Grand Challenges banner has yet made a significant contribution to saving lives and improving health in the developing world. When he took the stage this fall to celebrate the 10th anniversary of his signature global health research initiative, Bill Gates used the word naive 4 times to describe himself and his charitable foundation. It was a surprising admission coming from the world's richest man. But the Microsoft co-founder seemed humbled that, despite an investment of $1 billion, none of the projects funded under the Gates Foundation's Grand Challenges banner has yet made a significant contribution to saving lives and improving health in the developing world. Quote, I was pretty naive about how long that process would take, he said to 1,000 people in Seattle. All right. So, naive, the richest man in the world? No. Sorry, he can't walk it back. He has had an opportunity repeatedly to see the folly of supporting Monsanto. He owns 200,000 shares of their stock. Supporting GMO. Supporting the use of toxic and unapproved vaccines in Africa. His initiative in the polio vaccine eradication program in India caused thousands of deaths from the vaccine. No. Nothing he has done has worked. Not only has it not worked, it's hurt people. But had he put his money into $1 billion, $1 billion would have been able to give every single community in Africa clean water, a health clinic stocked and staffed with medicines they do need and a staff to help them, and food shelters where they could actually grow food and become more sustainable. That's what $1 billion could give you. If you knew how to spend it. Clearly, he has surrounded himself with the wrong people for this particular outcome. He is also a major supporter of the eugenics idea of population control. Isn't it amazing that people like the Rockefellers and Margaret Mead, excuse me, not Margaret Mead, she was a great humanitarian who founded the Earth First Foundation, Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood, they found that some people should be able to die off or kill them, eugenics. But they never thought of themselves as part of the equation. It's always the feeble-minded, those unemployed, those with bad genes. Yep. Well, if we were to make a moral decision about who has bad genes today based upon their social input, that would mean first up in your eugenics program would be all the wealthy people on Wall Street and all the politicians except maybe two in Washington, D.C. So much for this idea of grand challenges, Bill. Also, I remember when I finished one of my films. I've sent him every film. I've done all 53 major documentaries and never gotten a response. And finally, from our issues that matter, when we talk about becoming a police state, and I want to thank the people who supported our sister station, WBAI, last week, it was very successful. It raised enough money to pay the salaries for several weeks of the staff. We thank all the people because we did it in an unusual way. From 10 o'clock to 11, we played uninterrupted, no pitching. The entire noon to 1, no pitching. The 3 to 4, 4 to 5, no pitching. So when half of the entire afternoon was no pitching but pure programming, that showed that people were interested in the topic itself, how we became a fascistic nation, police state. Well, we have 80,000 SWAT teams raids last year. And they're not for the things like there's a hostage and you need a group to rescue them. It was just getting people to serve them with warrants or to people who were delayed on making bills paid. Well, I think most of you are aware of the young toddler who was severely brain damaged when her family was wrongfully attacked by a whole SWAT team. And, of course, they did a no-knock search. They went to the wrong house. And according to Nation of Change, after they went to the wrong house in Halberton County, the sheriff's department, they threw a stun grenade in, and it landed right on a baby, 19-month-old toddler, sleeping in his crib. And it just collapsed his lungs, burned its face, caused major problems. And so the house, the fire destroyed the house and or burned it up a lot. And the couple wanted to know where their baby was, but they wouldn't let them see him, then lied to him, said that the baby was fine. Baby wasn't fine, blew a hole through its chest, leaving third-degree burns along his face and torso, slammed the husband to the floor, and the wife could not help her screaming child. This is a SWAT team. And this is typical, by the way. This is typical SWAT team police mentality. And, of course, the Republicans just love this, and the complacent Democrats, corporate Democrats, accept it. No one's, except the people who've been involved, have challenged this. There's been no national movement to demilitarize the police. So anyhow, after all was said and done, this innocent family had to pay for the bill. So they went to the sheriff's department. They said, we're not paying anything. So they went to the county. No one was going to pay. So they're stuck with $1 million medical bill. $1 million. How about that? So what does it say about a country that glorifies violence, that allows SWAT teams to raid people's homes, including innocent people, and kill people, as they have, innocent people? And when they're found that they've made a mistake, nobody wants to be responsible for it, except the family that now has a mutilated child and $1 million. And nobody wants to help them. That concerns me. That and one other thing that no one seems to have paid attention to in India. You really have you talk about a fascistic new prime minister and government. Whoa. This is a letter that was sent to the law minister. It was also sent to the prime minister, the home minister of India, and the minister of human resource development. It says, As a concerned citizen of India, I would like to draw your attention to this extremely disturbing news report that indicates the intention of the Hindu Mahasabha outfit, an ideological affiliate of the Sangha Parivar, to install the statues and busts of Nathuram Godse, the murder of our father of the nation, Mahatma Gandhi, at public places across India. Moreover, the outfit has also stated on record its intention to write to you that the Gandhi murder case should be revised. And so it went on to talk about, in India, there's a whole movement afoot now to put up statues around India of the man who assassinated Gandhi. Well, I think they should be outraged by that, and they should protest it. Doctors agree, ineffective vaccine responsible for Hockey League mumps epidemic, from Huffington Post, Lawrence Solomon, quote, I'll just read two paragraphs. Past generations of professional hockey players were never at risk of mumps outbreaks. Today's players are, and tomorrow's will be, along with adults generally. These outbreaks, which the media portray as coming out of the blue, don't surprise anyone in medical circles who have been paying attention. Mumps outbreaks among adults have long been predicted by public health experts. Ironically, the mumps vaccine itself makes these outbreaks inevitable. A century ago, before sanitation and public health improvements, mumps was a risky disease. By the 1950s, it had become largely benign, a childhood disease that especially hit 5 to 9-year-olds and almost everyone by their late teens. Once infected, childhood mumps provided a lifetime immunity, making mumps rare in adults. Because mumps was dangerous in adults, complications can lead to serious problems. Mumps and other once perilous childhood diseases, quote, have been brought under control, and there is cause to rejoice in the fact that epidemics are becoming scarce. That was in 1955 from Dr. Losing, the chief epidemiology director of the Federal Agency's Department of Health. Not now. Quote, the mumps vaccine does not confer children with lifetime immunity. Repeated vaccinations have become the rule, and mumps has become an adult disease that threatens to be costlier in terms of both time off of work and health. But mumps vaccination has turned out to be even iffier than anyone could imagine. For one thing, the vaccine is a dud and does not do any good at all, end quote. So, finally, some people are waking up to the facts of what we've been told and realizing we have been misguided. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. For listening in. We're going to continue now with our conversations with remarkable minds. The topic is the path for a shift in consciousness for a new awakened paradigm of global and local leadership. My guest on Skype from the United Kingdom is Skyla Elworthy. She is an international peace builder and activist and founder of the Oxford Research Group in the United Kingdom, a non-government organization she established in 1982 to develop effective dialogue between policymakers, nuclear weapons scientists in China, Russia, and the Western countries, and their critics, for which she was nominated for the Nobel Prize on three occasions. She founded Peace Direct, and a charity to support and fund local peace builders in conflict areas of the world. She advised Desmond Tutu, Sir Richard Branson, Peter Gabriel on setting up a group called The Elders with Nelson Mandela. She's a member of the East-West Institute's International Task Force on Preventative Diplomacy, the World Future Council, and she is currently co-founder of Rising Women, Rising World, a vibrant global community of women taking conscious responsibility for building a sustainable world. Her most recent book is Pioneering the Possible, Awakened Leadership for a World That Works. Her websites are peacedirect.org and risingwomenrisingworld.org. Nice to have you with us today.
And it's lovely to be with you, Gary. It's a pleasure.
Increasingly in the United States, and I'm sure through much of Europe, people are disgusted with their political leaders and the corporations who support and fund their political campaigns and policies. As you mentioned in a speech you gave, 76% of people surveyed have no confidence that their children's future will be better than their own, and it will be far more harsher and likely filled with more pain and suffering. Now, our current political and institutional regimes are conducting themselves completely contrary to the demands now required to assure a sustainable future. And today's dominant leaders seem intent on exploiting resources without reservation that will in turn deprive future generations access to these same resources to satisfy their needs. And what baffles many progressive and spiritual awakening minds is, why is it so difficult for our leaders to realize the humanitarian and environmental threats challenging us now and are unable to foresee the far more violent catastrophes that lie ahead if we continue conducting business as usual? So clearly there's a vast gulf between the paradigm and beliefs that currently rule our policies and our economies and political actions and the new paradigm that needs to gain ascendancy and replace the old. So I'd like you to begin by speaking about the fundamental characteristics of the dominant paradigm of leadership governing our planet from the top down today. And why has it become so dangerous and threatening to a sustainable future? And why are leaders unable to change course and perceive the consequences of their decisions and actions? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, I think you've already put your finger on a lot of it, and I was listening to your previous talk while I was coming on the program, and you've certainly nailed a lot of the issues. But as I go around talking and listening to leaders in the military, in policymaking, in business, and even entrepreneurial leaders, what I notice is the key thing is short-term thinking. A week is a long time in politics, as you know, that expression that's used so constantly. But also, when business leaders are constantly keeping their eye on quarterly profits, they simply don't think about the consequences of what they're doing. And here, the people that we should be taking note of are the indigenous peoples of the world who, in every tradition, whether North American, Maori in New Zealand, Australian Aboriginal, and so forth, all say that decisions must be made keeping in mind the next seven generations. In other words, that we must treat the earth with respect and in such a way that the earth is able to keep on supplying our needs. What our leaders have forgotten completely is that this smash and grab raid that they're making on the earth's richness is coming to an end very fast. The earth can't sustain it any longer. And a lot of corporate leaders have sustainability programs, and many of them are not sustainable themselves, and many of them are even just what we would call greenwash. I don't know if that's a term you use in the States, but it's certainly one here. And so what is becoming important is that sustainability is not going nearly far enough. What we need to talk about and have action on is regeneration. In other words, how do our governments, our businesses, our not-for-profit organizations, our global organizations, how do they assist and support the Earth to regenerate? That means cleaning up water systems, as you mentioned earlier. That means covering up and reseeding the incredible scarring of the planet by open-cast mining. If you and I were to go up in a hot air balloon or a rocket high above the Earth, we would see these incredible scars that men have made digging rapaciously to extract minerals from the Earth. And in the course of those activities, just causing shattering pollution, not just for the future of our children, but for the peoples where they're doing this. As we know, this is happening with what we call fracking all over North America now, but also in places like the Congo, where the extraction of oil has caused the freshwater systems in many places to be so polluted that children are drinking water with petroleum oil in it, mixed in it. So when one looks at a scenario like that, it's and when you see the incredible difference between the spin, the public performances of some corporate leaders, for example, and some politicians, and what the actual system is that they're presiding over, it makes you, if not vomit, it makes you gulp to see the margin of distance between what they say they're doing and what they're actually doing. So, moving on to what you were saying about what is needed in our leaders, certainly, you know, we look for brilliance, we look for eloquence in our leaders, and these are important, but they're no longer sufficient. In this world of spin that we live in, unsubstantiated claims are made daily, and many of these leaders are making their claims with lobbyists breathing down their necks. So today's leaders have to find a way to become credible, because we don't believe them anymore. And this requires not only a radical rethinking of values, I believe it requires work on their part. And I believe that work is internal, because the leaders we need today have to have some self-awareness, and they have to be authentic. And the only way you can discover your authenticity is by inquiring within. So in half a century of working with those who really do have incredible authenticity, the most important lesson I've learned from observing leaders like Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu at close quarters, the most important lesson I've learned is that inner work is a prerequisite for outer effectiveness. Let me put that another way. The results achieved by a leader are in direct ratio to their perceived authenticity. And I can illustrate that, if you like, by a short story.
Yes, please do.
When I was, I think it was in the third or fourth meeting with Nelson Mandela, he came in and there was a room full of about 60 people. He sat down and started to speak, and he has a quite rasping voice. He doesn't do oratorial flourishes at all. But as he started to speak, I got shivers on my skin, what we call goosebumps. And 45 minutes later, when he finished speaking, I still had goosebumps. And I can only put that down to the measure of this man's authenticity. In other words, you knew this was a leader because there was no way he could be pushed around, no way he could be lent on, no way he could be diverted. And anybody who met him knew that. So I'll pause there because you've probably got lots of different questions, and I would like to respond to what you think your listeners might want to know.
You've answered several, but for several decades there's been visionaries. You just mentioned several. Spiritual leaders and health practitioners, environmental scientists, and civil rights activists who are convinced that what is necessary today is a radical shift in consciousness at a global level. Now, this doesn't only apply to individuals at the bottom, but also in our leaders and future leaders, as you mentioned. You say that what is necessary is a, quote, radical mastery of our inner being, and you just implied that as well just now, that you got goosebumps from Nelson Mandela, so that the human conditions can be rebuilt and reformed and progress, and resiliency can proceed from the bottom up. In practical terms, what is this shift in consciousness that is necessary at this moment, and what are the essential prerequisites for such a shift to take place, and what do you perceive to be the new set of critical values that we all should realize and embrace?
Big questions. Well, I think Einstein had it very neatly. He said, you can't resolve a problem from the consciousness that created it. And what he's talking about now is more than a shift in consciousness. It's actually a leap in consciousness that humanity needs to make. And it's being pressed upon us by the speed of environmental change, by the speed of climate change, by the breakdown of the systems that we've relied on. So it's almost as though humanity is being encouraged very fast, encouraged is a mild word, to look to itself and make this shift in consciousness. I think it's a huge opportunity. And that shift in consciousness involves a number of things. It involves, first of all, becoming self-aware. That means a daily process of self-inspection, reflection. Some people might choose to meditate. Some people might want to just have some quietness in their day. But some time that you spend every day really examining yourself, inquiring within, looking at what you do. Because it's only when people wake up inside that they're going to begin to make this shift in consciousness. And then I believe it's a question of identifying and getting together with others who have woken up in this way, because there's a huge reinforcement of what we do when we get together with others who've got it, who've understood the kind of messages that you're giving out in your programs, which I totally agree with. I think people can, to an extent, be shocked and frightened into action, but it's also good if they know that there's a methodology they can follow to enable them to acquire what I would call the inner power that they need to do this work. And that is to be found in listening within, listening to the wise wisdom voice that is within us. It involves also going into our own darkness, our own dark shadow, to not be afraid of our darker sides, because we all have them. And again, learning techniques to deal with that so that we can grow up into mature human beings. In the book that you mentioned, my new book, Pioneering the Possible, I've set this out in one of the final chapters, just the 11 steps that people can take to gain, or to begin to gain, this kind of consciousness. Because I totally believe that I've seen it, that the people who are actually succeeding in changing the world, whether at community level or national level or international level. The ones who are really making the change are the ones who have developed this inner power, this inner awareness to match their ostensible power in the world.
Let me do a little dissection there, because you're the one who inspired us to think about what was called the divine dissatisfaction and how mm-hmm. we can employ this as a way of awakening and becoming more actively active and conscientious in engaging in the world. And that leads me to the whole area of women who have yet to rightfully enter leadership roles fully. Much of this is a consequence of the repressive patriarchal structures dominating the thought patterns in our institutions. And I believe the per capita in the United States continues to be second worst among developed nations in electing women to political office. Only Japan is behind us. Mm-hmm. And many poor developing nations, including several Muslim countries, have greater representation of women in their political legislators than the U.S. So what yes. are the fundamental obstacles, particularly in our respective countries, U.S. and U.K., that curtail women from assuming greater leadership roles, and how does your concept of divine dissatisfaction motivate women and men to see mm-hmm. how this should be a shared responsibility?
Oh, huge questions. How long have we got? But you're quite right that my country, the United Kingdom, is just as bad as the United States. I think we only have 22% of women as members of parliament. And when I ask women, why is this, the women who are in parliament, they say at certain times of the week, it's like a bear house. It's the way that the men behave is like public school bullies shouting at each other, using very strong arm tactics to get their point of view across. And women simply don't enjoy, they deplore. They spend, a lot of their lives teaching children how to behave and listen to each other and stop fighting, and they don't want to do it in their adult life, in parliament of all places. It's interesting that countries like Rwanda, you mentioned countries in Africa, Rwanda has more women in parliament than any other country in the world. They've reached 52% now. And even Somalia, which is considered a failed state, has passed laws now to have a minimum quota of women in parliament. So things are progressing, but one of the reasons why women are so... well, they just find it distasteful to be in that environment. Now, the same thing's true in business. I was with a very major bank recently, and the director of HR was telling me that at level 3 and 2, moving upwards, they have almost achieved parity of women executives. But when it comes to level 1 and up to board level, it's down to 17%. And I asked what was going on. And he said the same thing. He said women find life at that level to be so cutthroat, so ungenuine, so violently competitive that they just feel uncomfortable. So what they are doing is now trying to take that apart and build a new culture at the top. They're, I think, one of a number of organizations, big companies, that are waking up to this because they're just not able to use the skills of women yet at top levels, and they would like to. So that's a beginning of an attempt to try to answer your question. But what the counterbalance of that is that if you look at the what you might call the grassroots, if you change from looking top down to looking bottom up, because the women, the people that I work with in hot conflict areas through Peace Direct, my organization, throughout the world, it's the women who are leading the way in resolving and preventing conflict. They are putting their lives on the line so that people don't get killed. And it's quite remarkable. Even in Pakistan, in the most violent area of northwest Pakistan, there's a young woman. He's When she was 15, she started an organization to get girls into school. And now, aged 26, she's going into the madrasas where young men are being trained to be suicide bombers, identifying them and going back with them to their families to explain why the Quran would not want them to do that. And she's so far talked 205 young men out of becoming jihadis. Now, that's not an isolated example. There are so many young women I know worldwide who are just taking the issues into their own hands and doing something about it. So that's what makes me hopeful. And I give many stories of what they're doing in my book.
Well, I believe that women are evolving more rapidly than men. And a gradual and ongoing trend has been going on for several decades, certainly the advent of modern feminists, but also let's give credit to ecofeminism and spiritual feminism. And I'd also like to see, and hopefully it'll occur, the kind of deep feminism that you speak about, aligning with a radical shift in consciousness, a parallel movement to take place among men that would lead to a more holistic, integrated expression of the deeper spiritual masculine. And there have been some mytho-poetic efforts to revitalize masculinity in order to make it more nurturing and enlightened and to enable men to act on higher values. None of those movements have breached into the mainstream, and they continue to be marginalized and relatively unknown. But I believe that based upon your work and many others, that masculine and feminine, the deep masculine, deep feminine, can complement each other and can together work for a force to bring about a more rapid shift in consciousness. And I really appreciate all your work. We're out of time, and thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights with us today.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your questions. And may I just say that these deep feminine values are really brought to the fore on the website of risingwomenrisingworld.com. And we would welcome visitors, questions, and love to talk to you again at some time. And thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a continuation of our conversation with Remark of Mine, Skylia Elworthy, Elworthy. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I just wanted to mention to you and everyone that our retreat, of course, coming up in January, has been full. And I do have a couple of openings yet for the work-study position. And I thought you might want to go over that a little bit with everybody so we can see if anyone else wants to get on board.
Sure. Well, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a wonderful retreat. It's going to be beautiful weather, and it's going to be a time for people to de-stress, decompress, open up, examine what's important in their life to this point and what they want to do with their life going forward, and realize that there are tools that they can help in this transition. They're human tools. Mitchell Raven, yourself, John Q, myself, cooking classes, gardening classes, homesteading classes, hydroponic classes, the deep and insightful lectures, meditation and yoga, power walking and exercising, juicing. In fact, we're going to have everyone drink at the beginning of the day a smoothie, the kind of smoothie I make for myself, plus with wheatgrass and ginger shots throughout the day, plus juicing galore. So that's what it's supposed to do, helping people who want to start the new year with a whole new attitude and this time stick to their promises to themselves and others. And there's no reason we can't start over. We can. So that's what the retreat is about. And for people who cannot afford the full $2,000, which is very inexpensive, but who can't afford that, we have what's called a work study. They can work hours each day and also attend classes and workshops. So it's the best of both. And they can call you and give your number.
Surely it's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. Give me a call.
Thank you. Now let's go over and say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about the killing of two NYPD officers, reigniting multiple firestorms.
Okay, well, we look forward to that because we know how this is going to play out, and in the press it already has. And so I look forward to your insights on this. Eutrice Sneed, right now, please stay with us.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame?